Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. A drop of blood, perhaps two, a concept in a Stanford University dorm room developed into a $9 billion Silicon Valley startup born of the promise to revolutionize the U.S. healthcare industry by relying on just a couple of drops of blood for tests. No more hypodermic needles, no more skyrocketing costs. Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes gave this pitch.
We've made it possible to run comprehensive laboratory tests from a tiny sample.
The young 20-something college dropout promised the moon and found powerful men orbiting her, including backers such as George Shultz, Henry Kissinger, James Mattis, and Rupert Murdoch. And it all appears to have been a mirage. Holmes now faces federal criminal charges. This hour, On Point, the rise and fall of the House of Theranos. Join us. What did you make of Elizabeth Holmes? What questions do you have about how this might illustrate Silicon Valley culture? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. A bit later this hour, we'll hear from a whistleblower who is instrumental in helping to bring the company down. I'm just delighted with our guest this hour. We have with us from London, Alex Gibney. He's an Academy Award-winning director. His latest HBO documentary out just this week examines Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes. It is called The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley. Alex, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, David. Good to be here.
And joining me in studio here in New York City is John Carreyrou. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal, author of the best-selling book Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. John, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
I don't think we really understand this story, if not for your reporting. And a bit later in the hour, we'll talk about your process of reporting. I want you just to sketch for us briefly at the start of this tale, who is Elizabeth Holmes? How does she present herself and start to cast this spell?
Right. So she drops out of Stanford in late 2003, middle of her sophomore year. She has this vision for a medical device that's going to take tiny samples of blood from your finger and run all the labs on it known to man. She idolizes Steve Jobs, goes on to, you know, hire people, raise money, and over the ensuing 10 years, builds a company that come late 2014 is valued at $9 billion. She's kept half the equity, so she's worth almost $5 billion.
So considered the greatest quickest female entrepreneur in Silicon Valley.
Youngest, I think Forbes came up with this descriptor for her that stuck, youngest self-made female billionaire. Which was true, because the company really was valued at $9 billion.
And all from an insight that she had in her dorm room at Stanford as she presented it. There's a scene that I want to take from Alex Gibney's documentary, The Inventor. He and his team have interviewed Phyllis Gardner. She's a tenured professor of medicine at Stanford University and investor. She is registering Elizabeth Holmes' allure as a young student, coming to her for guidance and for support. But she also recalls resisting that allure pretty easily as the young student sought her patronage for that vision.
She wanted to incorporate microfluidics and nanotechnology into a patch where you could sample the blood and detect an infection, and then at that point deliver antibiotics to it. Well, you can't do that. It's impossible, physically. Antibiotics are not potent. You cannot do that. The reason you have a big IV bag. Okay. So I said, Elizabeth, that's fun, but I don't think that's going to work.
That from Alex Gibney's documentary, The Inventor. John Carreyrou, what about Elizabeth Holmes allowed her not to hit that response at every, professor of medicine, every backer of biomedical engineering that existed out in Silicon Valley? Why is it that she got so many yeses and so few of these?
Right. So two key traits about Phyllis Gardner. One is she's a woman. And two, she's a trained MD. with not only a lot of medical experience and a lot of medical teaching experience, but also a lot of industry experience. Phyllis has been part of several companies. And so she knows the science, and she's also not a man. And the reason I'm bringing that aspect up is that if you follow the rest of the story, every other backer and champion that Elizabeth assembled over the ensuing 12 years were men, starting mm-hmm. with Channing Robertson, who was her chemical engineering professor and a dean at the engineering school at Stanford, and then moving on to Don Lucas, the famous venture capitalist who groomed Larry Ellison himself, later some executives that she charmed at Walgreens that became the retail partner of Theranos, and then all the way up to Rupert Murdoch, who put in $125 million into the company, and David Boies, who was the company's outside counsel and who I had to do battle with.
And from reading your stories and also from watching the documentary of Alex's, it seemed as though there was a certain class of folks. I mean, I remember reading a Ken Auletta piece over a decade ago, in which I was like, there are a lot of heavy hitters here. They don't seem to be medical people. You know, Henry Kissinger, as we mentioned, Jim Mattis, as we mentioned. There was Bill Frist, the former Senate Majority Leader, but who had been a surgeon and a healthcare executive. But, you know, people brought together by folks like George Shultz. We have a clip here from Tyler Shultz, among the first Theranos employees to alert authorities in 2014 that the results of its highly promising blood testing device simply didn't hold up. And Shultz said that board gave Elizabeth Holmes incredible latitude, including his grandfather, that is the former Secretary of State, George Shultz. Here's what Tyler Shultz had to say to Nora O'Donnell on 60 Minutes.
She's on the cover of magazines. Inc. calls her the next Steve Jobs. Do you think the board of Theranos believed she could be also that kind of revolutionary leader?
Yeah, definitely. The board was completely sold.
Did your grandfather, George Shultz, think that too?
Definitely.
Alex Gibney, you've done documentaries investigating the collapse of Enron, an epic corporate fraud. You looked into the world of Scientology and the incredible culture of control and of seeming deception that you presented to the public. What distinguished this story? What made it so compelling for you to spend so much time on?
Well, to some extent, she was a character I recognized. I mean, if you look at somebody like Jeff Skilling, or even in his own way, David Miscavige, the head of Scientology, I would say that they were both prisoners of belief. And that is to say—
Prisoners of belief. Tell me what you mean.
Well, what I mean is that they believe in something so strongly that when the distance between what is real and what is accomplishable grows enormously far from the dream or the belief in what you can or should accomplish based on who you imagine yourself to be, instead of tailoring your dream or getting real, you just pretend that your dream is real. And so you engage in a kind of cognitive dissonance, and you allow yourself ultimately to engage in fraud because you pretend that your vision is working great when it's not working well at all.
I want to take a call now from Detroit, Michigan. Alex is calling. Alex, this is a story about a couple drops of blood and many billions of dollars, people's health on the line. What do you make of it?
But what I make of it is, first of all, thanks for taking my call. I just want to preface this with that I am a phlebotomist, so my job is to collect laboratory blood specimens from patients both in the hospital and out of the hospital, and I'm responsible for preparing those specimens for testing. So what I'd like to say is that the idea that you could test even one of the hundreds, if not thousands, of tests that we perform, if that you could run that test on such a small specimen, it's kind of radical and a little bit far-fetched just from the science perspective of it. And, I mean, just the idea that you could prick a finger and from that get all the answers is a little bit far-fetched. But the technology just isn't there, and it's only recently been where it is today. Secondly, I'd like to say that giving patients false hope that such technology is just on the cusp is a little bit irresponsible because the amount of time I spend with each patient, about half of that is just convincing them a lot of times that it's worth it to have their blood drawn, to go through such a small needle prick, to draw their blood. And so if they're already so unwilling to have their blood drawn because they're in a vulnerable situation, to present this on the nightly news as they're sitting in their beds, it sort of paints us in a bad light as medical professionals.
Alex, I really appreciate that informed and professional perspective that you offer there. And we'll be talking a little bit in a bit later in this hour about the journalism that reflected sort of the hope and promise of this. Alex Gibney, in your documentary, there's this incredible, I guess it's a computer graphic that you use, showing inside these magical Edison boxes, right? That hold all this hope, where sort of robotically they can take the little pipettes of these tiny drugs and do the tests they need to do. And in reality, your graphic shows, kind of animates alarmingly, how quickly things break and get contaminated, and how things go almost haywire, like a dystopian version of a Charlie Chaplin film. Did she believe, in your estimation, what she was peddling publicly?
It's hard to know for sure, because I wasn't there, and I was, even though my producer managed to talk to her for about 5 hours one time off the record, I was never able to interview her. But by all accounts, I think it's a weirder thing than did she believe. She knew that things were going wrong, so it's a fact that she knew that the machine wasn't working properly. The question is, when she would pitch the device to investors or journalists, did she convince herself in that moment that things were really working well in order to be able to lie more effectively? That is the question. And I do believe that that's what she had to do in order to lie that effectively. But the fact is, she knew the machine wasn't working.
She had reason to know that what she was saying was not true.
Yes.
We are dissecting, we are analyzing, we are taking metaphoric pipettes to the blood testing company Theranos, its meteoric rise, its subsequent collapse, all under founder Elizabeth Holmes. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have for our guests, those who have studied Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos most closely? Did you buy into the Theranos promise? Did you ever invest? Did you get tested with Theranos? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're discussing the formerly high-flying blood testing company Theranos and its Silicon Valley founder Elizabeth Holmes, now brought low apparently by the laws of biomedicine, of gravity, and of the U.S. criminal code. You can join our conversation. We have the people who have studied the company and the creator best. What questions do you have? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. With me from London is Alex Gibney. He's an Academy Award-winning director. His latest HBO documentary is all about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. It's called The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley. And with me here in studio in New York is John Carreyrou. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at The Wall Street Journal and best-selling author of the book Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. There was some pretty tremendous stuff captured in Gibney's documentary, Alex Gibney. Holmes hired the celebrated documentarian Errol Morris to direct a series of promotional videos for Theranos. In this particular clip, a variety of patients are responding to the ease and simplicity of the company's blood testing device.
One drop?
Bring it on.
All set.
That's it?
How are you feeling?
Feeling good.
The same little thing can do exactly what the other vials did?
Yeah.
That's like life-changing.
That's from the documentary The Inventor by Alex Gibney. It's a couple of the promotional videos directed by Errol Morris. I got to say, Alex, he really used that stuff to good effect to get the feel of kind of the embrace, the promise, the excitement, the hype that surrounded this company. You also had in your documentary interviews with journalists, prominent journalists, Ken Auletta of The New Yorker, sort of a leading media journalist for decades, a gentleman who's an experienced reporter for Fortune magazine, who wrote the cover story that essentially heralded her and cemented Elizabeth Holmes's reputation. How had the press talked about the promise of Theranos, and talk a little bit about how much insight they actually had into how the company operated?
Well, I think, you know, Elizabeth Holmes represented a story that a lot of writers, even grizzled, experienced journalists like Ken Auletta, and there's another important journalist named Roger Parloff who first put Elizabeth on the cover of Fortune magazine. You know, there was a story they wanted to believe in, and that story was young, female entrepreneur coming up with a transformative invention for healthcare in Silicon Valley becomes a huge success. That was a great story. They wanted to believe in it. They reported it, and reasonably carefully. But one of the valuable things about both Ken and Roger coming on board and agreeing to talk about their experience is now in retrospect, they realize how much and how badly Elizabeth had lied to them. Ken had put a shade of doubt in his in his piece. It was indeed a phrase that John would later pick up on called comically vague, referring to how she described the process of her machine.
Such a Roger, great line.
Really good line. But Roger, I think, in the film particularly, is haunted by the fact that he missed this. And still to this day, I think you can feel his pain, even though it's quite understandable when you realize that she lied to him. But that's why, you know, seeing how personally he took it testifies, I think, to how badly he wanted to get it right, even though both he and Ken really did want to believe in the story that Elizabeth was weaving, which was this tale of a young female entrepreneur makes good and does something magnificent for society.
And I've got to say, I was struck by the way, excuse me, in which you incorporated her affinity not only with Steve Jobs and how he dressed and presented things publicly, but also the inventor Thomas Edison, after whom she named her boxes, but also who seemed to have that kind of, you know, fake it till you make it on some of these things that we now take for granted as some of his signature inventions. You know, there really was this drumbeat of incredibly positive reporting until it seemed to me, until I read in the Wall Street Journal back in October of 2015, John Carreyrou's first investigative piece about Theranos. John, you described the company's proprietary testing device as largely performing inaccurately, making clear it was not reliable, making clear that not only was it not going to displace things, it was not even able to replicate the reliability of these other larger, more expensive tests. Later that same day, October 15, 2015, Elizabeth Holmes joined CNBC's Jim Cramer to make her case to rebut the claims made in that Wall Street Journal piece.
This is what happens when you work to change things. And first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world. And I have to say, I personally was shocked to see that the Journal would publish something like this when we had sent them over 1,000 pages of documentation demonstrating that the statements in their piece were false.
Now, the first time I actually saw that clip was in Alex Gibney's documentary, The Inventor, that's just out. It's worth also noting that Elizabeth Holmes made a plea to one of her key investors, an Australian-born billionaire named Rupert Murdoch, to stop the publication of that Wall Street Journal piece. It should be noted, of course, that Murdoch essentially effectively controls the Wall Street Journal, he and his family. I've written a lot of critical things as a media reporter of Rupert Murdoch in that day. But, you know, mega kudos for a guy not intervening to try to do damage control for, what was it, $125 million investment?
That's right.
And that's an incredible backing from the top boss.
Yeah, I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know he had invested. He invested basically at exactly the same time that I started digging into the company. And then we published in October, 9 months later, in October 2015. And then I didn't learn of Murdoch's investment in the company until October or November of 2016, a year after my piece was published. And at that point, you know, my jaw dropped when I heard it from a source. And I thought, at first it was disbelief. And then I thought, well, this is a great twist for the book.
Incredible.
So I got to report it out. And I spent some time reporting it out and learned that they had met face-to-face six times, including four times before my first investigative story was published. And the last of those four times was 2 weeks before it was published in his corner office in the News Corp building in Midtown. And she kept bringing up the story, hoping he would kill it, and he declined to kill it.
In a few minutes, we're going to talk with a key source for you and a key whistleblower from inside Theranos, Erica Chung. But one of the things I think it's important to set the terms with is your reporting was not only remarkable, but it was particularly remarkable for the culture of secrecy, the culture of control that, as you depicted, as Alex Gibney depicts it, defined how Theranos operated.
Right. It was a not a healthy culture. It was a culture in part that was inspired by the secrecy of Apple. Elizabeth Holmes adored, you know, Steve Jobs, idolized him and idolized everything Apple. And she knew about, you know, Apple's famed secrecy around its product launches. And so she sort of emulated that. But I think it also stemmed from her personality. She's very secretive. I'm told she's inherited that trait from her mother. From the early days of the company, she compartmentalized things. She wouldn't let, you know, the engineers communicate that much with the chemists. She fired people often. And then when her boyfriend, Sonny Balwani, joined in late 2009, he became the enforcer. And really, that toxic culture went into overdrive.
I want to now reach out by Skype. From Hong Kong, I want to bring into the conversation Erica Chung. Erica is a former Theranos employee and a whistleblower, a source for the Wall Street Journal, but she helped to expose the company's numerous deceptions, numerous failings, the vast canyons of disparities between what was actually happening in the labs and what was being said publicly. Erica Chung, welcome to On Point.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
My goodness. When you entered, you worked there for under a year. But when you entered, you believed in it. What did you believe in? Why did you join?
I believed in the vision. I kind of was sold on, you know, the possibility that technology had reached this point that we could, you know, run blood diagnostics on smaller samples, at least for some blood diagnostic tests. And I think I was really sold on the possibility that we could make these tests cheap enough that people didn't even need insurance to have access to medical diagnostics. They could pay for it out of pocket. And I think for me, just exiting out of my undergrad, that was a story I was really compelled to be a part of.
And what was your job there?
So I started off in research and development. And I was responsible for then integrating the Edisons into the clinical lab where all the patient processing would happen.
The magical boxes.
Yes. Yes, the magical boxes.
And what were you seeing behind the scenes yourself, and what were you hearing from colleagues about how progress was actually being made on making those tests plausible and making them reliable?
There was quite a bit of despair behind closed doors and in the laboratory. And at first, being so young, when I entered into the research and development lab, I'd anticipated, okay, this is being in the sciences. You expect that there's going to be high failure rates. That's why you're here. You're here.
Erica, are you still
with
us?
We can start testing it on patients.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
No, you're good. We can hear
you. Okay. Yeah. Essentially, there was a lot of despair amongst everyone in the laboratory. They, you know, initially people in research and development, that was kind of our job. Our job was to make the test work, and then put them into the clinical setting.
And what was the response by Elizabeth Holmes, and her top executives to the fact that the information being run back up the chain was, hey, this isn't playing out, guys?
It was a bit strange. No one really. So a good example is during Thanksgiving, I had run a patient and the patient sample kept failing. It kept showing outlier data, I'd reported it up to all the high-level management that things were going wrong. And essentially, they brought in another lab associate who was pretty underqualified, entry-level position like me, and she had just deleted data points and said, oh, those are outlier data points for a patient sample. Now it's good to send out. And when I had reported to the higher-level management, they just kind of looked at it like, yeah, it's wrong, but we got to get the patient samples out. There was always excuses being made for why it just, like, carelessness didn't matter.
Mm-hmm. And then what convinced you to reach out to federal regulators? What convinced you to speak ultimately to John?
I think initially when I was in the company, I was hoping that somewhere in that building, something was going right, that something was going right. And that maybe I had just been seeing things the wrong way. But at the end of the day, we were still not telling patients when we did mess up on their samples that there was an issue, that there were problems. And when John came to me and basically said, hey, I've been hearing these rumors about Theranos, it was almost a sigh of relief for me that other people had been seeing what I was seeing and starting to come forward and say, this is not okay. And then that also gave me the opportunity to talk to a lawyer and figure out that it was very easy to report this information to regulators. And because I had an inside perspective, I would be able to point them in the right direction with specific details where Theranos could no longer just kind of lie and refuse to show them where the Edison devices were or where the labs were that patient processing was actually going on.
I mean, it seemed as though it was the medical version of bait and switch, right? Where people who came and demanded to be allowed to see people from Walgreens or people like, I guess, working with the vice president or others who came in to do it, had their, had their samples whisked away and then done on very conventional machines bought by standard manufacturers that were in the back room somewhere, bought by Theranos itself.
Yeah, it was exactly that. Like, what went into processing one blood sample? When they would do those demos with investors, all the investors thought, I got my blood drawn, you stuck it in the machine, and it would run. But actually what was happening is a lab associate would take that blood sample, run it into a back laboratory where there are about 16 people waiting all to split up the sample and run it on all these different machines. And it was just, it was crazy how the whole thing was staged, and our entire team was put on hold anytime an investor came through or any sort of prolific figure.
It sounds like a scene from a medical version of The Sting or The Grifters. I'd like to take a call now from Madison, Wisconsin. Elena, you're on the air. Join us. Your thoughts on all this?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. Especially with the talk around regulations, I'm fascinated by how this kept getting passed the FDA, but I'm more interested in comments about what does everyone think, how this will impact future regulations for new innovations and new inventors, because I feel like she has essentially potentially set back that industry by years, especially if you're a female in a STEM field trying to get forward, that there's going to be, I would hope, extra scrutiny. But is it there? You know, there's a considerable process to bring these sorts of things to market, and it can take decades. How do your guests have any response on that, about how they think this will impact in the future? And I'll take the response off air. Thank you.
Thank you, Elena. Well, John Carreyrou, do you have any thoughts about what the legacy is of this for the kinds of agencies that approve and regulate this stuff?
Right. From a regulatory perspective, I'm not sure that that the Theranos debacle is actually going to change much. If anything, I'm a little bit pessimistic because one of the loopholes that Elizabeth Holmes exploited is the laboratory developed test loophole. And it's basically, it has to do with tests that are devised by laboratories with their own methods. And it sits in this regulatory no man's land between the two main health regulators, the FDA on one side that regulates the diagnostic equipment that labs buy and use, and on the other side, CMS, the Medicare agency, which regulates labs. Between those two agencies, there's this loophole, laboratory-developed tests, and no one is really regulating it. The FDA was serious about beginning to regulate it at the end of the Obama era. And unfortunately, when Trump got elected, there was a new head of the FDA, and the policy stance of the FDA changed completely. So that loophole in particular doesn't look like it's going to be closed. I think, though, where one can be more hopeful is on the enforcement side. The Justice Department has now charged the two perpetrators of this fraud, Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani, with criminal fraud. And there's going to be a trial. If convicted, they could go to prison for many years. And I think that is going to be a deterrent for Silicon Valley entrepreneurs in the future.
Sonny Balwani being one for top executives for a few years.
And boyfriend.
As well as her boyfriend. Another point not disclosed to investors. We're discussing the former blood testing company Theranos and its founder Elizabeth Holmes, once a cover figure on business magazines, now in the dock trying to beat charges that could force her to face up to 20 years in prison. Alex Gibney, John Carreyrou, Erica Jung, stick around. We want you to stick around. Join our conversations. What are your questions about Carreyrou's reporting or Gibney's documentary? What do you find most compelling or surprising about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're discussing the now-defunct Silicon Valley blood testing company Theranos and the public captivation with its now disgraced founder, Elizabeth Holmes. Follow us on Twitter and the Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me from London, Alex Gibney. He's an Academy Award-winning director. His latest HBO documentary is The Inventor, Out for Blood in Silicon Valley. From Hong Kong by Skype, we have the technology investment analyst, Erica Chung. She's an insider Theranos whistleblower. She helped federal authorities unravel the company's lies and served as a source for my third guest who's with me here in studio. That's John Carreyrou. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter at the Wall Street Journal, author of the best-selling book Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. I want to go take a call or two from our listeners. We've had a bunch from New Milford, Connecticut. Bill, sounds like something this was on your radar.
Oh, very much so. When all this was going on, when John's story broke in the Wall Street Journal, I was a heart patient going through some pretty serious heart surgeries. And so blood testing was a big part of my life. And I couldn't believe that the fake it till you make it ethos of Silicon Valley was being applied to literally life-saving or potentially life-saving blood testing. Mm-hmm. Related to that, at the time, I was in public relations in technology for 25 years, and I never did any work for Theranos, but the Theranos story was one of the reasons why I decided to get out of the business, because I was so fed up with sort of the amoral, fake it till you make it, screw you culture of Silicon Valley and tech in general.
Huh.
And my final point was that I couldn't believe that late in the game, even as Theranos was going down in flames, people like Tim Draper and some of the original investors were out there vehemently publicly defending the company. It just points again to how lost technology and the Silicon Valley industry is. Those are my points.
Thank you so much for that, Bill. Tim Draper being a lead investor in Theranos. Alex Gibney, your team interviewed Draper. He was on there and still kind of buoyant on the company, it sounded like, in terms of its promise anyway. We are getting a number of of folks weighing in and saying we've got one commenter on our website, Greg Blonder, says as a VC, sometimes during bubbles like the telecom Greg says he's a VC, means a venture capitalist. Sometimes during bubbles like the telecom frenzy in the 90s, people invest on the greater fool theory, get in early, boost the company, ride the wave, and sell before anyone notices that it's flawed. Not my philosophy, more common than people realize. During the Theranos frenzy, investors agreed someday a single finger prick would lead to a full health profile inevitable, and they bet Theranos would be purchased early by a desperate or scared acquirer, eyes wide open. We have also a call coming in from Palo Alto, California. Ram, tell me your thoughts on all this.
I wanted to say John's book, Bad Blood, everyone should read it. Every sentence is amazing. The HBO documentary was great. I want to emphasize that the deception was abhorrent. So much about the company was unacceptable. One thing that people should still be optimistic about is the possibility of running multiple diagnostics on a small drop of blood. And the reason is because there are already products out there that we use in the hospital on a regular basis that do this, the iStat, the Piccolo Express, and the thing is just that the claim that was made was in the same vector direction. It was just 500 or whatever tests. It's not that it's not going to be possible one day. Even the Siemens machines use just microliters of blood. So people should be encouraged that there's real science out there. There's even real products that are FDA approved that are doing things in this vector direction. And the last point is, who cares if we'd use microliters of blood? It's not essential to it would be great, but it's not like it's not transformative per se that they're using microliters, that people are using microliters of blood. It's fine to use a small vial. We have six liters of blood circulating. It's really for people, for the bulk of people doing preventative medicine, we don't need microliters of blood. It's actually much more painful to use a lancet than to have an excellent phlebotomist to draw your blood. So anyway, these are technical points. The book was amazing. The deception is obviously unacceptable.
Well, thanks, Ram, for all of the above, including the blurb that'll no doubt be on the next edition of John Carreyrou's book. Erica Chung, you know, there's something that strikes me. It's like watching, Minority Report, that Tom Cruise movie with all these things that seem to anticipate things that came true 5, 10, 12 years later, in terms of technology. Yes, maybe we don't have personal flying helicopters, but they kind of anticipated the way in which drones would be much more commonplace and the how the tablet would have personalized news, the cookies that would tell the Gap exactly what size jeans you had bought last. Was there the sense of, hey, if you can imagine it, it is doable?
I mean, I think this was beyond just imagining it's doable. There's definitely, like the previous listener was saying, there is technology that already exists that is able to run a multitude of tests just using a finger stick. This whole spectrum of blood panels and blood tests cannot only be done on a small point of blood. But I think there is the possibility where, having consumer base, being able to be in your own home and do and run some of these blood diagnostics like you would with the diabetes test is very feasible and very possible. And we probably will start seeing a shift where these types of blood diagnostics are going to start happening.
In April 2016, Elizabeth Holmes was interviewed by NBC's Maria Shriver after federal regulators had accused Theranos, of failing to hire and train qualified staff to oversee blood tests, among many other infractions.
I feel devastated that we did not catch and fix these issues faster.
What do you hold yourself responsible for?
I'm the founder and CEO of this company. Anything that happens in this company is my responsibility at the end of the day. We stopped testing and have taken the approach of saying, let's rebuild this entire laboratory from scratch so that we can ensure it never happens again.
Now, viewers of Alex Gibney's documentary released this week on HBO, The Inventor, would have seen that scene. What's remarkable to me is not so much her saying what a seemingly responsible corporate chief would say. In some ways, it's that voice that you know, we now have intimations may not actually have been her real voice, Alex Gibney. And indeed, you also included it, the fact that so many things that she said turned out not to be the case. You included, if I recall correctly, kind of a collage of times that she talked about her inspiration, which was the quick metastasization of skin cancer in her uncle to the point where he died not very long later, you know, unable to see his child grow up. Having died of cancer, and she talked about it again and again. Do you have even any reason to doubt that origin story? Did that turn out to be true?
Well, John might be a better person to talk about that, but I do know that she wasn't that close to him. And I think the more salient point was, yeah, okay, he died of cancer. Would testing with the Edison device have saved him? Who knows? It's just – but it was a very compelling and emotional moment because, somebody close to her died. And I think what it really testifies to is her ability as a storyteller to connect with people's emotions. I mean, in a way, that's what her hero, Steve Jobs, was best at too, was telling a compelling emotional story about a product. And that was, you know, at the heart of her success in terms of fooling people.
As a documentarian, how do you approach Alex Gibney dealing with somebody whose assertions are probably a coin toss likely to be true or less?
Well, weirdly, I've had a lot of practice in that. I mean, I've interviewed a lot of people who have lied to me straight to my face, and so over time you get used to it, and you know that it could be happening, and I think that's and luckily in this case, you know, between Erica whistleblowing and John writing his fantastic book, you know, I knew going in that that I was dealing with somebody who. Was high on the mendacity scale. But I do think that, you know, one of the interesting things for me is how and why people lie and how they think they can get away with it and how sometimes they think they're entitled to do it because they have this grand mission, which allows them both to lie more effectively, but also to excuse it to themselves. That I don't think is the good news. It should be a lesson for all of us in terms of spotting frauds in the future. You know, when you see somebody who has this kind of messianic and very emotionally compelling vision, it's not always surprising to find that they're not telling the truth.
And Alex, you include a quote from the behavioral economist, the great Dan Ariely, talking about saying basically that people should have empathy towards Elizabeth Holmes. And just to summarize what he says that, you know, you can ask how she does this, but it would miss the point if you don't understand her journey. In a sense, it's really a cautionary tale about all of us. What is that cautionary tale?
Well, the cautionary tale is you have to understand that we all have to understand that in some ways we're hardwired to be irrational. One of Dan Ariely's books is Predictably Irrational. And that when you're irrational and you're ruled by your emotions, you come up with excuses for why you feel the way you do. And if you allow that cognitive dissonance to grow, then you're really in trouble because then suddenly you're defending something that's not defensible, and that's really the lesson for all of us. And it could happen in a domestic argument where you know you're really on the wrong side of the argument, and somehow you feel emotionally compelled to push it for all sorts of reasons. I think that's why if you see Elizabeth only as a purely bad apple, like some uniquely fraudulent person, then I think you miss the broader context of this story, both in terms of its application to Silicon Valley, how you spot these kinds of frauds, how we end up believing these frauds, how really good journalists end up being taken in. She's extreme in one way, but she's also connected to the rest of us.
John and Erica, I want to talk about what it was like to be on the other sides of the divide from one another in this. What was it like to finally talk to Tyler Schultz? What was it like to talk to Erica Chung and to get them to earn your trust? And when they took you by the hand and brought you inside, what was that like?
Well, it was important for me journalistically to make contact with them because I had one source, and that source was anonymous because I agreed to grant him confidentiality.
He remains anonymous.
And he remains anonymous. He goes by a pseudonym in the book. And he was a very good source since he had been the lab director in a position to know what he was talking about. But nonetheless, I wasn't going to be able to go to press with a story based on just one anonymous source. And so when I made contact with Erica and Tyler in particular, and they corroborated virtually everything that this lab director had told me, for me, that was really the jackpot. Both Tyler and Erica, as Erica suggested earlier, were young and green and just out of college, but they also appeared to me, from the first contact, to have very good heads on their shoulders, and to have strong moral compasses, and to be these smart, educated, young, people and former employees of the company who were speaking out for the right reasons, and so I found them credible, even though they were young, and Theranos was inevitably gonna call them out as junior employees. They came off as incredibly credible to me as sources.
And Erica, what was it like to take that leap of faith to trust in John? And also, what was it like then to see what he was able to report in print?
Yeah, it was a bit of a leap of faith. And I think in retrospect, Tyler and I were a bit naive on even, what signing an NDA was and the consequences.
A non-disclosure agreement, sure.
A non-disclosure agreement and the legal action that would sort of follow through. But both of us initially were were completely anonymous as well. And we were, frankly, both lucky to work with John. And throughout this whole process, he did a lot to ensure that we remained anonymous, that he kept us as confidential sources. And honestly, even when doing the documentary, a lot of us had a lot of trouble, say, working with HBO or any other reporters, because we had built up so much trust in John and so much loyalty to him, because he had done such a good job reporting the story. The initial release of the Wall Street Journal article honestly did not seem to shake up things too much. A lot of people still had a lot of confidence in Elizabeth Holmes. They thought this was an attack because she was a woman, or that this was like the, classic media trying to bring someone down who was on top. But then the fact that he did such a good job in his investigative reporting to release report after report after report, exposing all the different scandals and lies that she had woven in this story, it, for us as sources, we really got lucky. And this was the best possible outcome that this could have had, this story. There are many people who have come forward against fraud cases, and it has not ended well for them. But I can speak for myself, and I'm sure with Tyler, we really got lucky that John was so thorough with his investigative reporting.
And Alex Gibney, last 30 seconds here. Does this collapse happen without the reporting, as well as without federal regulators taking a look? How important was the journalism here?
Hugely important. And that's one thing that we should all be aware of at this time when, our president is calling the press the enemy of the people. Good journalism motivates investigators in ways that is palpable, sometimes by embarrassing them and sometimes just pushing the story and the facts forward. It's a hugely important thing that John did.
An important lesson among many from Alex Gibney, director of HBO's The Inventor, out for blood in Silicon Valley. Alex, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And our thanks, too, to Theranos former employee Erica Chung, a whistleblower who helped federal authorities unravel the company's lies. Erica Chung, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Also, John Carreyrou, the Wall Street Journal investigative reporter who blew this into the open and author of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, our thanks to you.
Thank you.
You continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website. It's produced by Anna Bauman, Brian Hartzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Rally, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, Adam Waller, with help from Matt Hoisch, Asil Kibi, and Alex Pena. A happy birthday to our most junior producer. That's Zella Folkenflik. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm David Folkenflik. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.